There's three sides to every story. There's my side, your side, and the truth.
Which Kelly are you?
Edward. People call me Ned.
I photograph what my conscience asks me to.
Ned, they want to have him in the movie!
Mad Max 2. It's my kind of movie.
Shut up! Shut up!
Your friend can't come backstage.
Oh, he's disabled. I'm his carer.
You're blind.
He's an equal opportunity employer.
The kids who are sick cannot do the hip-hop anymore.
G'day folks and welcome to another episode of The Curb. My name is Andrew Pierce and this is a podcast that takes a look at Australian film, Australian culture and a whole bunch more. This podcast is proudly recorded in the lands of the Whadjuk people of the Noongar Nation and I pay respects to their elders both past, present and emerging. Now, if you caught the last episode, well, yeah, it was part one of chatting to Kia Roche-Turner, whose new film, Wormwood Apocalypse, the sequel to Wormwood Road of the Dead, is going to be screening at the Sydney Film Festival this week, as well as Monsterfest later on in the year. It recently had a screening at the Brisbane International Film Festival and went off their gangbusters. In part two of this discussion, we talk a little bit more about the production of Wormwood and also about what makes Kia a filmmaker. A bit later on in this particular interview, I mix up the title of Sam Raimi's third Evil Dead film, which is The Army of Darkness, and for some reason I got it mixed up with the title that came into mind was Zack Snyder's Army of the Dead, and of course, you know, it's a completely different film. However, the answer that Kia gave me is still quite an interesting one, so I didn't correct myself in the moment. Correcting myself now in case listeners go, oh, I think he's meaning the other thing. But yeah, Kia's answer is still spot on. Anyhow, enough beating around the bush for me. Let's jump back into the interview. Was there a point, where was the point for you where you realised that you were talented and creative and were making good things? Was there a point?
Question, because then it makes me sound like I think I'm talented and creative.
But you are, though. You are. And surely, because you continue going on, there's got to be a self-realisation of it.
I was stoked when I realised I could draw. I was about 13, and I was like, man, I'm pretty good at this. And I wanted to be a comics artist first. I always loved writing. I remember sitting, I've been 12 years old, maybe 11. I was in year six, and there was a... the teacher gave out an assignment to just write a poem, and I just remember sitting down and just picking style. I went, okay, I'm going to write it in the style of Benjamin Patterson, you know, Man from Snowy River, and it just flowed out of me so quickly, and nobody else in the class could do it. And I was like, oh, can't everybody just do this? And it's great, and you feel really special, and people pat you on the head, and they get you to, you know, they pay you $10 to do a Christmas card or a birthday card for a relative, and you feel special, and that's what kids want more than anything, is to feel like they're special, and you know, to be able to draw and write, and eventually, you know, start making cool little movies that people love, and you know, get a lot of pleasure out of. It's just, there's no other feeling in the world for like a sensitive, shy little kid, you know. And so that I was able to find my strength. And, you know, my older brother was instantly smart and just always good with socializing. He just had a weird social strength. And I'd see that and I go, okay, that's his strength. And then my younger brother, you know, he's just like a tough dude. Like, he was really good at sport and like he just had a lot of confidence. And I'm like, okay, well, he's got clear strengths. I don't know what my strengths are. I'm just kind of shy. And then when I realized I could draw and paint and I had a sort of tendency towards art, I'm like, okay, that's my strength. And that's the thing that's going to give me confidence in life. And so, you know, for most of my life now, that I've really drawn a lot of strength from the arts, you know, and you know, that's why I'm here still doing it when I'm 42, you know.
Yeah, still getting away with it.
We were talking about safety on set before, and one of the things which really struck me as quite a really cool invention for the film is this air gun thing that you've got going on, which, you know, disarms people and shoots them and blasts them back with air. The whack stick. That's brilliant. I was about to say, what do you call it and where did they come from?
me and Tristan were writing the original Wormwood 7 years ago, and we wrote part of it in the Megalong Valley, and we would take these long walks in the valley and we would hit rocks out into the valley with like a club, and the rocks would make this zizzing noise, like bzzz, and we called that game Whack Stick. So anytime we couldn't be bothered writing anymore, we'd go, oh, go play a bit of Whack Stick, and, you know, we just hit rocks into the valley. And so that name stuck with us, and it felt Wormwoody. And so when we came up with this idea of it that effectively is like God's punch, like we want something that could punch you but, like, incapacitate you, like not hurt you. And so the idea for this gun is that it knocks zombies off their feet, you know, it incapacitates, you know, these people that our hero Reese is trying to capture without killing them. And so we came up with this idea of a gun that fires a concentrated fist of like methane gas, and just it's like this giant hot, you know, King Kong shaped fist of air that smashes into their chest and knocks them out, and so he can capture them. And we called it the Whack Stick. And the thing I love about the Whack Stick is it's just so practical. Like, you know, our guy, our art director, I can't remember whether it was Tim Namor or Jason Tully, built the Whack Stick. One of them built it. I think it was Jason. And it's just, you know, it's just like a pretty standard gun prop that looks amazing, but like there's no functionality to it. And then Tim, our art director, you know, I sort of said, look, I want something that fires like an explosion of oxygen. I want it to be practical. Like, I don't want to do this digitally. I want it to be practical and safe. And he worked out a way where just he bought a fire extinguisher, ran the hose through the barrel of the prop gun, and then, you know, you just kind of activate briefly the fire extinguisher, and this massive shot of oxygen, you know, like sort of punches out of the gun, and it's huge and it's explosive and it practically looks amazing and it doesn't really cost anything. Like, these fire extinguishers are really cheap and it looks awesome, you know? And that's what we, that's, you know, really how we like to do things. If there's a practical, easy, cheap solution, I'd rather do it practically, because I just think if you overuse digital without a big budget for your digital effects, it just ends up looking crap. And so what you should do is do everything as practical as you can, and then you augment digitally. And so that's why we did all the muzzle flashes. Like, all the muzzle flashes are just, it's one of the lighting guys flashing a quick hit of light into the actor's face while they pretend to, you know, do like a sort of back kick on the gun, and then we add the muzzle flash in later. And because muzzle flashes have a tendency to look a bit cheap, I was really interested in the idea that every time it fires, because what's going on in the Wormwood world is petrol is being you know, petrol has been nullified. There's clearly something viral in the air that's affecting flammable substances. So when the gun fires, these embers kick out and there's a huge kick of smoke. And so people aren't really used to seeing that done digitally. And so I found that that really helped sell the muzzle flashes that were digital. So we didn't have a single real gun on set. They were all either plastic or like prop built, or I think we had one proper metal shotgun that's a real gun that had a block barrel. Like, there's not a single gun on our set that could actually fire a blank. Like, it was all done with a combination of, you know, digital lighting effects and digital muzzle flashes, smoke and embers. And, you know, that's how I feel that, you know, digital stuff should be done. It should be done 80% practically, 20% augmentation digitally. And it seems to have worked really well, because I think a lot of the effects in this look quite good.
No, it looks really good. Yeah. And what I took away from it as well is there's something that, I mean, it might be a while before we have conventions and stuff like that, but, you know, I get the impression this is kind of a very, there's something that is very inspirational for people who want to do cosplay and things like that. Like, there is so much to take away from this film that people could easily be walking around conventions next year dressed up as these characters, and it doesn't cost them much to do it, and they look spot on. You know, there's that kind of fandom has got to be pretty exciting, I imagine.
It was really exciting, and that was one thing I just did not expect from the original. You know, like, we had a lot of cosplayers being Brooke and being Barry, because all you need is some biker leathers, some American football shoulder pads and a hockey mask. And if you've got access to something that looks like a fake plastic sawn-off shotgun, that's it. That's all you need. And you're Barry. And so we've had some really great cosplayers, you know, and it would be just as easy to do Reese from this film. You know, they both have very iconic looks. You know, Reese with the half face mask and the goggles and the, you know, sort of military, you know, jungle fatigues. Yeah, pretty easy to put together, and it looks great. And, you know, you look like something from like a, you know, Far Cry video game.
Yeah. All right, last question, because there's one aspect which I'm really keen to find out about, because, you know, it wouldn't be an Australian film if there were any drone shots in it. But you guys managed to kind of make the drone shots feel brand new and feel, like, inventive and exciting and full of life in a way that I haven't seen in an Australian film. How did you go about deciding what to actually do a drone shot with and planning for the drone shots as well?
Well, we know this guy, Paul, you know, he mostly shoots really full-on drone footage of, like, stock car racing. So he can get these tiny little drones into, like he can do a 360 of a car that's doing a 360 on a dirt road, like, and doing jumps and stuff. Like, the guy is, like, a ninja. And so there was a little bit of kind of conversation about, do we use him for some things and other things? We're not sure. Because he specializes in small drones, which kind of look very, the footage looks droney. And we wanted some of the footage to look quite cinematic, but when we bought the cinematic drone guy out, who's got this big drone, big expensive drone, he just looked at what we wanted him to do. And he's like, no way. We can't do any of this stuff. He's like, you guys are tripping. Like, this is too, I mean, I'll crash my drone. Like, no way. And we're like, oh, okay. And then we brought Paul out and said, well, what do you think, Paul? And he goes, yeah, the easiest piece. Like, when do we start? And so we're like, I think Paul's our guy. And, you know, he crashed his drone like 7 times, but, like, he's got like 3 or 4 different drones that he uses. He's kind of used to that because he's a stunt drone operator. So he's one of these guys that, like, he races drones. Like, he's just a phenomenal, like, drone operator. And so he was getting these drones to fly down, you know, 200 meters up and then in underneath these archways, long archways of gum trees. And he was doing stuff that you just couldn't do with one of those big cinematic drones. Like, you just couldn't do it. And so that's why I think some of the drone shots look quite interesting, because, you know, they swoop down near the car and then kind of, you know, through the trees and then around behind, quite close to some of the performers. And you're just like, the only way you could do that is if you've got a very small drone being operated by a master. And so, yeah, I'm quite happy with the drone footage. Doesn't fake any other movie's drone footage. Like, it feels, again, it has that kind of low budget, risky, you know, sort of semi-dangerous feel to it, you know, that is so important for a film like this. And, you know, it was dangerous because he did crash his drone like 6 times, but, you know, I think he thought it was okay once he saw the footage. He's like, all right, it's worth it.
Yeah. It's something I'd never seen before, and I was just like, oh, it made me sit up and just go, wow, this is, there's an energy to it that is kind of a rarity, and that's what I really loved about those shots. Yeah.
Well, that's what we want to do. We want to go back to that kind of Sam Raimi throwing the camera around kind of feel, you know. We've got to try and build on some of the stuff that he was doing in Evil Dead 2. And it's so funny, I went back and I rewatched Evil Dead 2 recently, and I'm just like, dude, I thought we got any close. And I'm like, we didn't even get close. Like, even what that guy did in the 80s, I'm just like, my Lord. Like, that guy is just a master. But you've got to try, you know. You've got to lift on what people have done. And the one thing that we had that Sam didn't have is a drone. So, you know, there you go.
So Wormwood 3 then, is it going to be more Army of the Dead or more Thunderdome?
If I had to pick one, it'd be, you know, more Thunderdome, just because Army of the Dead is just, it's $200 million worth. And, like, from the opening title sequence, you're just like, yeah, this is Zack Snyder, this is $100 million. And, you know, we're doing the opposite of that. It'll be more down and dirty, exploitation, you know, putting as much visual bang for buck as you can on screen with a tiny budget stuff, you know. I'd like to have a bit more budget than we had on Apocalypse. Apocalypse is, you wouldn't want to go any lower than that, and you couldn't really. A lot of people paid a very uncomfortable price for us to have a budget low enough to have all the creative decisions. And I would hope if Wormwood does well enough, you know, we'll be able to get a little bit more money next time just so people can be a little bit more comfortable and I won't break so many actors. But, yeah, I mean, I'd probably just get, you know, close to the same cast, same crew. You know, anybody we didn't kill in this one, we'll get back. and we'll continue there. I mean, we're already starting to come up with ideas. It's pretty exciting. And I would, to be honest, you know, I'd love to go straight into it. I would love for this to be the next thing that I write, Wormwood 3. We had such a great collaborative experience with everybody, and we ended up with a film that, I mean, we just love so much that I'd love to do it again, just rinse and repeat. But it really comes down to, you know, do people react to it? Does it get a similar kind of word of mouth to the first one? You know, it'll be up to the fans, really, you know, if they make enough noise. You know, we'll get to make another one. Like, you know, and that's, you know, you're always nervous when a film's coming out. You're just like, oh man, I hope it does well. If it does well, we get to do another one.
And then, you know. So are you excited? I mean, obviously you're excited about the Sydney Film Festival, but what's your feelings going into the Sydney Film Festival?
Well, it's actually premiering tomorrow at the Brisbane International Film Festival. Yeah, so it's premiering there tomorrow, so that'll be... because of, you know, travel restrictions, we can't go up. So Blake's nearer there, so he'll be there, and a bunch of people, crew from Queensland, and, like, you know, a bunch of friends up there, and a bunch of fans, and, you know, cross fingers, hope it goes well. But then the Sydney Film Festival, that'll be the Sydney premiere, that's on the 6th at Event Centres, and again on the Dendy. Both of those sessions are sold out, which is really good. Monsterfest, we're screening in Melbourne, in early December, they're moving towards selling out, and they haven't been selling for very long. So there seems to be interest for it, but you just don't know until, you know, audiences get excited or until those critical reviews come in. I mean, who knows? All I know is I like it. I've seen it 100 times now, and I'm like, yeah, I'm really happy with this. And, you know, that's all that a filmmaker could really hope for and wish for, is, like, it really doesn't matter what anybody says or how well it does or how well it doesn't do. I'm really proud of it, and I think it's a righteous follow-up to the first one. And, you know, that's really, you know, if you can get there, then, you know, half the battle's won.
Yeah, I think you've nailed it. It's really a lot of fun. And, you know, you were saying about your critic friend before, who just spun it again straight after it finished. And he's not the only person I've heard say that. Matt Eels from Cinema Australia, he messaged me before I watched it, and he's like, mate, I watched it, and then I literally, as soon as it finished, I said to my wife, I've got to watch it again. And so he watched it twice in a row.
Really?
Yep.
He watched it twice in a row. Wow.
Yeah.
And there is no greater compliment, because you can't.
I know.
Lie about that. You know, it's pretty easy to go, oh, I really liked it. But if you watched it twice in a row, that means you really, really liked it. So, oh man, I hope, that's a general feeling. You know,
yeah,
that's
I loved it.
Yeah.
I had a wonderful time, and, you know, I then went back and watched the first one. So I didn't re-spin, you know, Apocalypse twice in a row, but I did at least go back and rewatch the first one after watching this one. And
that's pretty good, though. That's almost in the same ballpark. That's pretty much the same thing. That, because, like, if you'd watched it and went, oh, this is a pile of shit, you wouldn't go back to the other one because you'd be too angry. But the fact that you went back and went, oh, I need to double check. But I mean, that's great. I mean, that's a huge compliment in itself too, Andrew. Thank you.
Yeah. I mean, there was something about, like, it's been years since I'd seen the first one. So I was like, oh, I just got to revisit. And it helps as well. Like, there's any special features on it too. So I'm hoping that the Blu-ray for this one has got a lot of special features as well.
So let me ask you a question. You watched Wormwood Apocalypse Clean and then went back to watch Road of the Dead.
That's right. Yeah.
Now, did you have any trouble, like, remembering as you were watching Apocalypse, like, you know, any of the bits and pieces, oh, zombies do this, and oh, she can control zombies, that's right, you know, did you struggle with any of that?
No, because that kind of stuff had already been in my mind throughout the years since I'd seen Road of the Dead. You know, it had already been, like, as I was saying before, I'd already been comparing other zombie films and shows to Wormwood Road of the Dead, because I'm like, oh yeah, but these guys did this, and that was pretty cool, and hey, you know, Walking Dead, you're kind of boring now. Like, you're feeling old and all this kind of stuff. So I was already comparing other films to that. And so it's been in my mind for a long time. Yeah.
Because one of the things we were hoping to do was to, like, even if you hadn't seen Road of the Dead, if you just went into Apocalypse blind, we wanted it to be an experience that could still be good for a viewer.
Oh, it definitely will be. Yeah.
But the other thing we didn't want to do, and there was a little bit of argy-bargy back and forth about, hey, shouldn't you guys be a bit more specific about rules of the world? And we're like, no. People are smart enough to catch up. And my feeling is, like, you learn pretty quick that zombies are a power source, and it's pretty obvious that she's controlling zombies. And, you know, the idea of hybrids, you know, half human, half zombies, it's not so crazy complicated. It couldn't kind of work out what's going on. And that was something that's very important to me, and Tristan, is lack of exposition. It's like, I hate exposition in movies so much. I love a movie that, like, doesn't assume that the audience is stupider than a bag of bricks. And so I'm like, hey, these aren't like hardcore scientific concepts here. Like, it's pretty standard genre lore. You know, if you can't work it out, you probably should watch more movies.
Exactly. So, yeah. It's not like, I mean, speaking of Lynch and things like that, I was hearing about how when his Dune came out, they gave people a glossary so they could read it, like a page glossary prior to watching the actual film, so they understood what was going on. And it's like, no, this is, as you're saying, this is genre staple stuff. People know what's going on. And so there is a shorthand to everything there, and it's very approachable. I think if people are coming to Apocalypse not having seen the first one, they're going to be safe. They're going to be perfectly fine.
And that little June movie is so funny, you know, when that the princess turns up, floating head in the universe, and she just expositions at you for 10 for, oh man, yeah, like it's clearly something that was tacked on at the other producers, where this woman pops up on screen and she just goes, I'm going to tell you about House Atreides and House Harkonnen and the Bene Gesserits, and like she just talks for like 5 minutes. You're just like, just shut up, like, just show me a sandworm and like start shooting people. I don't care. You know, and most people don't, you know, but they do need the minimum amount of information. And like, I do think that information should be able to be told without like just bucket loads of verbal exposition. There's nothing worse than that, you know?
Yeah, exactly. It feels organic. It feels natural, and it feels part of the world. And as I was saying, like, this feels like a living thing that has, you know, when the credits roll, the world is still living out there. And I'm looking forward to revisiting it down the line when it happens.
When we're three.
Yeah.
I want to start writing that right now.
Yeah. And I'm glad you guys don't stick with the, you know, two as well. You know, it's not Wormwood 2, it's Wormwood Apocalypse. Like, it's nice to have the subtitle.
a lot of people wanted Wormwood 2. A lot of people were really fighting for that. But I just, it didn't feel right. I don't know. I like fantasy novels and stuff, and you don't get Lord of the Rings and Lord of the Rings 2. It's Fellowship of the Ring and, you know, the Two Towers. You know, give it a name. Like, just call it 2. I'm glad we finally found the right word too. I mean, we just weren't sure what to call it. We were going to call the TV series Chronicle, which is kind of unimaginative, but worked. And I think Matt Tristan sort of, we're big fans of Apocalypse now, and just went, yeah, Apocalypse, that's about right. Yeah. What does Tristan want to call? He wants to call the third one Wormwood Annihilation. I'm like, all right, yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah, that sets an expectation of what's going to happen as well. You know, there's something about a word, because you expect something that's going to happen. You expect an apocalypse. You expect Road of the Dead. You expect something like that. And so walking into the film and you get that, it has your expectations met. You have a great time. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, and that was an interesting conversation that we had with the distributors on the original film. And we sat down with Greg and Slab, who were working at the Studio Canal at the time. And they had a really very, very polite lunch with us. And they said, look, Wormwood is a title that nobody really understands. So, you know, we're thinking of calling it, Wormwood Road of the Undead. And here's why, you know, people need to know what they're clicking on. You know, like, there's a genre expectation. You know, like even like a weird title like Predestination, you know, the Spirit Brothers science fiction film, that's a weird word, like Wormwood, but it does express what the film is. You know, you're going to the destination previous to when you existed. It's a time travel film. And so, you know, like that's why, you know, we sort of took it on the chin and we were like, you know what, you're right. I don't like Road of the Undead, but Road of the Dead rolls off the tongue. Let's go with it. And so I kind of do believe that, you know, a title is important in the marketplace and you've got to give and take. And Wormwood Apocalypse, even if you don't know what Wormwood means, everybody knows what Apocalypse is. So you know you're going into an apocalyptic film. And Wormwood Annihilation, like, you know there's going to be explosions, guns, and a lot of shit is going to explode. And, you know, like, it's going to be carnage, you know. And so people who like on-screen carnage, you know, click that button and buy a ticket and, you know, yeah.
Do all the things, yeah.
Well, Kia, do all the things.
Thank you so much for your time. It's been a really great discussion. Yeah. And
thanks, Andrew. It's always good to talk to a genuine film lover, film geek, film nerd. You know, but you're my people, man. So, I mean, I could talk to you for another whole hour. You know?
Oh, yeah, definitely. But we've got lives to live and films to promote and stuff.
Yeah,
it's easy to get lost in the rabbit hole. I know that I'm going to be chatting to Matt about this for a while because he is just... As I was saying, he's just hooked on it. He's absolutely loved it and all this kind of stuff. And I've thoroughly enjoyed and loved it too. So I think that's the thing, is that having these discussions outside of the films, and it's great talking to you, but it's also great talking to fellow fans about it and all this kind of stuff and having fan theories and everything. It keeps it alive and exciting. Yeah.
And that's the whole thing. You want to make a film that, you know, even if it's just a small group of people, if a small group of people are still talking about your film 20 years later, you know you did well.
Yeah.
So, yeah, here's hoping.
Yeah, fingers crossed.
And there we have it, folks. Kia Roche-Turner talking about his latest film, Wormwood Apocalypse. I really hope you enjoyed these two interviews that I've done with Kia. I really enjoyed talking to him. He's, look, a fountain of knowledge and fountain of information, if I can spit those words out. I also listened to the interview that he did with Matt Eales from Cinema Australia, who I mentioned in this particular interview, who watched the film twice in a row, a rarity, I can't really think of that many films that I've ever watched twice in a row. Maybe the last one that I did that was Keyboard Fantasies, which was a film that came out last year. Loved that film a lot. I highly recommend you going along and listening to Matt's interview too, because not only, he asks some similar questions, but Kia gives different answers. And that's the thing which I find really interesting. I try and listen to as many interviews as I do, or read as many interviews as I do, as I can, of the people who I'm interviewing, because I don't want to be asking the same questions, and they probably don't want to be giving the same answers. So I try and give something new and interesting to them, just as I try and give something new and interesting to you, the listeners, because hopefully... new things are a little bit more interesting. And there's so much that's new and fascinating here. I really enjoyed this interview. I really enjoyed talking to Kia, and I loved watching Wormwood Apocalypse. And I hope that if you're heading along to go and see the Sydney Film Festival presentation, that you have a blast. And if you go to Melbourne and watch it at Monsterfest, you also have a blast there. And fingers crossed for Perth, Adelaide, and maybe Hobart and Darwin as well, that we get screenings too in the new year. Fingers crossed. Can only hope, because I think this would be a really brilliant audience film. Anyhow, let me know what you think about this particular interview and what you think about the Wormwood series as well. Head over to the website, thecurb.com.au. Drop a comment in the post below. And if you want to go the extra step, help keep this website nice and independent, and head over to patreon.com/thecurbau, where you can listen to some of the audio podcasts if you sign up at the $3 level, that are exclusive to that level. There are some interviews, audio interviews, that are exclusive there. Follow us on social media, Facebook, Twitter, you know the places. All right, folks, I really enjoyed this. Once again, I'm sounding like a broken record, but I did. I hope you all stay safe and look after each other and be kind to one another, and I will see you on the next one.